You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. Joining him is everyone's favorite coach and hair model, Chris, aka Tex McQuilkin, Power Athlete's Director of Performance. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
I'm not going to invest this much time and energy if that part, I mean, and I know this is what we talked about with the job, the strength coach. Like, I can't continue to be invested in people that are not going to fucking die on the sword for us.
Well, yeah, to quote Jim Wendler, I can't relate to people that are unwilling to die for what they do. But this is also the coaching paradox. It's you give, 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 and you care more than the people that you're giving to.
That was one thing a mentor told me a really, really long time ago, is you can't want it more than your athlete or your client.
That's the reason I sold my gym.
Yeah.
When I worked with a client, had all these people come in, they met their goals, and they thought, I was so excited for them to meet their goals, and they were like, yeah, I'm okay. I'm not going to continue, and they quit. Mm-hmm. I met my goal. I'm going to go ski and do other things. And I'm like, but we just started. You met everything. And I realized that day that the day that I wanted it more than the client, I shouldn't do this job anymore.
You got to get those right people in.
Yeah.
Those are the ideal clients then. But I'm running a lot of that comes down to education,
too. Did Jim say that in our podcast, the second one or the first one?
The number 98, the first ever.
What did he say? I don't relate.
I cannot relate to people that are unwilling to die for what they do. Power Athlete Radio, episode 98.
I cannot relate to people that are not willing.
Unwilling.
That are... God, I love the fact that you remember the quote exactly.
Well, it...
To die.
Fucking
into your brain.
I cannot relate to people that are unwilling to die for what they believe in.
What they do.
Or what they do.
Because believe is different than that. Because I believe in different things, but I do coaching.
Yeah, that's... Well, and then the other thing that kind of fucks me too, if I got to help DJ with anything, like all of a sudden that, like, I'll try to work till noon and then go up and help him and do everything, and I haven't been able to do it because of working with those guys.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And then the hilarious thing was, Shanji says to me the other day, he's like, man, you'd be so much better if you could come more often. And I was like, oh. Yeah, well, I'd like to, but unfortunately, I have a big block of my day devoted to working with your athletes. And he's like, yeah, I'm really sorry that I asked you to do that. And that's what he said.
Really?
Yeah. And instead of being like, giving me a hug and being like, you know what? Thank you. You fucking have crushed it. Let's figure a solution to get you better. And it might look like personal, you know, like something. Like, hey, dude, here's my schedule. Come, like, we can do this shit. Like, is what we would have done. If I asked somebody to do something, I would have, like, come and met them halfway and been like, yeah, no, I asked you to do something, and, like, I know this is negatively affecting you, so let me fucking make up for it. Let me do the right thing, which is create the fix the deficit.
Not everybody thinks like that, though.
But that's how we think.
Well, yeah. There's a, like, selfishness component to all that.
Yeah. And then at that point, I was sitting there, and that was what I was thinking about writing. I wrote on the mode yesterday 4 hours. Didn't listen to a podcast, just wrote around the thought. And, like, I thought to myself, like, their problem isn't strength conditioning. And, like, here's my other thing, too. If, like, what, we're going to train to go fight Gordon Ryan? And if, like, you're not willing to go out there and fucking stamp a motherfucker's head with your name, you know, to the point where, like, your name's on your back, you need to have every person go out there and remember as soon as they say your name who you are, which is how I took every single NFL guy game out to when I played. To, like, go out there and not do that, it's fucking hard for me to swallow. It's hard for me to, like, get excited to go fucking work with people that aren't in for a penny, in for a pound, you know?
Fighters don't think like that. They're not in. They don't have that belief of the stamp of the name. They're pretty lax. They're not as lax as they were when they first started with us, but they're still, like, eh.
Yeah, meh.
Eh.
Meh.
Yeah. Oh, I get skill work later. Eh. So they're not bought in on training. Like, full bore 100%. Like, let's fucking go. But they don't need to be, because it's still better than what they would do without it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a huge fucking problem for me.
But it's...
Are they aware of that, though?
Fuck yeah.
I got to have a come-to-Jesus moment.
But football is different. Football and weightlifting is the only... Track and football are the only sports that training is married to the sport. So the same with jiu-jitsu, it's the same with lacrosse and basketball and baseball. I don't want to fuck up my swing. I don't want to fuck up my jump shot. I don't want to fuck up this or that.
So it's same, the same with the world of shooting, too.
Same with shooting. Mm-hmm. So it's this is not a new battle. The only people that don't have a problem with it are track and football. And why do you more think often that than is? Not at high school. Let's just turn this into a podcast.
No, I mean, this is our podcast.
More often at a high school, guess who teaches track?
Football coaches.
Football coaches.
Yeah.
And that's the question we ask our dudes, that the high schoolers that come to us. Are you a football player running track, or are you running track? Are you a track athlete? And they're like, they're football first. They identify as football first. I'm a football player running track. Okay, well then this is how I want you to factor in your starts. So we can teach you how to start well outside of blocks versus a block start, which also translates to a block start. Just a lot of the RAF shit. So there's benefit. And if we know what essentially your mindset is going into this, then we can change how we coach you. But the minute that we don't meet them halfway where they are, that's when the coaching paradox comes in, because we believe they want it. And we want it and start to want it more than them. Like, we understand where they are as a 24-year-old dude on top of the world, potentially.
Yeah.
And what you would do back then.
Oh, I did it.
I know.
Yeah. I mean, I fucking died on the sword.
And now you know where they are. They don't know where they are. So you do want it more than them. Yeah. You want it for them?
Yeah, I want it for them.
That's what I mean. You don't want it more than them. You want it for them. Which changes everything. Which changes and starts this thinking and conversation. Because you want it for them more than the skill coaches. More than they want it for themselves. And they say they want it. And this goes back to Joe Lewis' quote. You know, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody's willing to die.
Yeah.
So this is a story as old as sport. It's just a matter of, you know, managing the expectations of the athlete. And that's where the coach comes in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I told you the story. My second year in the NFL, we went to go play in the New York Giants. I had to play against a guy named Keith Hamilton, who was an absolute fucking savage. And we had a heavyweight fist fight, and I would say he won that battle just by the mere fact that I was literally bruised, beaten, and like I couldn't open my hands the next day. My hands were so basically bruised and battered that I got up the next morning and I had to run them under hot water and cold water and do contrast in the sink, just trying to get my hands open because they were so beat up. Like, my palms were bruised. Like, I was all fucked up. And after the game, I was so upset. I ripped his picture. I told you this. I ripped his picture out of the program and I put it in my wallet. Literally taped it every time I'd open my wallet to look at his face. And every time, like, I mean, think about taking out your wallet, taking out credit card, cash, driver's license, whatever, and I look at his face. And that was the intensity at which I went to train. If I ever needed motion or, like, motivation or didn't feel like doing it, I looked at that and I fucking went. And I remember when Roth and I were training, and I went back and he's like, you know, what's the motivation this year? How is it going to be different? And I slid the wallet across from him. He looked at the picture and he's like, let's fucking go. And Roth was in. Rop's like, you know, like, Rop was literally in for a penny, in for a pound. I mean, I remember we used to go out and he was like, dude, he was like, I will hit you with the fire hose as hard as you want. You tell me when it's fucking stop. And I'm like, there's no quitting this in me. And I think that's why Rop and I have always been such good friends, is I never gave up. I never quit. And I wanted it. And he wanted it for me. And I wanted it as bad as he did.
Yes. And so I've witnessed him also meet the athlete where they are. So you were all in, and Raph had the capacity and the capability to meet you there.
Yeah.
But also, if he's working with a 9-year-old whose dad wants it more than that kid, he's not coaching for the dad. You know, he has the ability to meet that 9-year-old where.
Yeah, but how do you do the job half? Like, I'm not to say that you half-ass it, but how do you...
But you craft it into a game and fun, and you train intent. So intensity, drive, purpose. So think about, you know, tag.
Yeah.
There's but, intent. But, I mean,
you're talking about a 9-year-old. We're talking about, like, 24, 25, 26, 28-year-old well, professional athletes.
But then we can scale that to it. So if it's working with a 9-year-old, it's different than a 29-year-old professional football player.
Yeah.
So then there's this bandwidth, this spectrum of where we can meet that. But then it all comes down to intent. So if dudes choose to roll with the intensity of 10 cities, but then when it comes to strength and conditioning, they just go through the motions.
Well, for the people that are just joining us, welcome to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. And I'm sitting here.
We just dropped into a conversation.
Yeah, no, this is the best way. I just figured, like, I'd give people a little context. We're sitting here with our good friend, Dr. Matt Zanis, obviously Mr. McQuilkin and myself. And what we're talking about is being a strength coach, working with athletes, developing them. And I'm sure, Matt, you've dealt with this too, where you get invested in your athletes and you see the potential and you see their progress. And you start to get to a point where you want it more than the athlete.
Some do. Some, yeah, coaches get there. Not all. But the young coaches. I mean, when I was a first college coach, I realized the benefit that college sports gave to me, and I had no strength coach. Now I go to Division I, and I thought they would want it. I thought they would value and work hard.
I remember you calling and asking me about it.
But the realization is, nah, let's just go through the motions. Because all they want to do is ball.
Playing football, man, I've had so much time to reflect on this, and I reflected a little bit on it on my 42 things that I learned since then. One of the ones that it took me almost a decade to admit to myself was I really loved to play. And I was so scared that they were going to take it away from me at any moment that I didn't really ever enjoy it, because I was kind of like one of those things where it's like, I didn't like her anyway. Fuck her. You know? And like the girl breaks up and you're like, I never liked her anyway. And inside you're crushed. So I was really afraid to like invest and like admit to myself. I just was like, I'd blow it off. But it's a job. I like it this. And it's like, no, I really like to fucking do it. I like to train for it. I like the competition. I like the camaraderie. I liked the study. I liked all those things. And I I seized it, but I didn't really like... It wasn't as meaningful as it could have been, because I think I always kept this kind of like foot in and out a little bit, because like, what if it ends today? I don't want to be heartbroken, because I was always worried, like, what if you like really invested in something and all of a sudden something outside your control like snatches it away? I remember when it ended, my brother called me and he's like, man, I don't know how you deal with this. He's like, I've been a lawyer most of my adult life. And what if somebody just woke up tomorrow and said, you don't get to be a lawyer anymore? And he's like, after I've like, you know, basically invested my entire life in this profession. And then all of a sudden someday somebody who you have no control over just takes it and slides you away. And I was like, oh, I'm totally fine. I'll find something else to do. And it was because I was, you know, but I mean, it lasted 10 years. So like, why did I waste? And I think with a lot of people, you know, because I used to run into this all the time, even in high school. Oh, I could do what you did if only I tried hard. And I'd be like, oh, well, why didn't you try hard? Like, what are you saving yourself for? And not to say when I went out and played, I didn't play with that effort, mm-hmm. but I think I like emotionally made this deal with myself. Like, oh, you don't really like doing this. It's just transactional. It's a job. When I actually really fucking liked the physical contact, I liked the battle. I liked the fist fight. I liked the strategic aspect. I liked the learning. I liked the fact that like here was like this open loop system with like our defense versus theirs. And I think if I had admitted it to myself sooner, I would have immersed myself into more aspects of it, like to the point where like I should have known, like I knew what other people were doing, but I should have like understood the intricacies better of the game, to the point where like I probably could have just like a year later been their offensive coordinator. Like mm-hmm. that was the level of like access I should have had. And there were guys I played with that were like that. Mm-hmm. I just think you get to this idea where, you know.
Well, I think it's a...
On the sport note, different roles require different levels of cerebral sport awareness. So a center in Nick Hardwick, correct me if I'm wrong, he needs to then communicate to the quarterback, and there's a different layer of the mental game than what was required of you of guard and tackle.
Well, I played next to, in Philly, I played next to a tackle that didn't learn his place, and I played with a young guy like Hank. His whole deal was call the mic, and then we basically made magic. And, you know, when I went to go play, you know, and the other thing, which is really upsetting, if I think about it now, and it kind of pisses me off, I was never a right tackle. I played there 4 years, and I was a natural, like, even to this day, as I'm sitting here looking, I can see everything out of the left side of my eye. I can't see shit out of this, like, peripheral over. Like, the way my brain is wired, for some reason, on the left side, like, I have, like, a fisheye. Like I can see what's behind me here.
Well, was that all the down blocks from the left side that jammed up your brain?
I have no idea what it is, but when I'm driving, it's perfect. So when I drive on the left side, obviously, we're like the way we drive, I can see anything on the left side over here. When we were in the UK driving on the right side, it was literally like I was hysterically like looking because I can't see very far out of my right eye. And I just think that naturally I somehow built a skill set to play on that left side. Playing out on the right, I felt really like not very comfortable, but I played there for years because I could do it. But what sucked is I played out of position for a number of years when I could have been, I think, much better if they would not have played me out of position. But I should have kept my mouth shut and fucking stayed in Philly. So what are you going to do?
Oh, you self-selected for it.
Yeah.
At that point.
Oh, I just had a natural skill set.
Well, what would you say to an athlete that makes the sacrifices for the team? Is the team just taking advantage, or are they looking out for the best of the athlete?
I think the teams will always take advantage. They have to. So with the team, you know, there's nothing better or I'm sorry, in the team's mentality, you know, they have a spreadsheet. It's a business at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. The players are just merely cogs and commodities. And if there's a bigger commodity with a cheaper price, they'll slide it in. If that cog doesn't work, they'll pull them in. And I think that the loyalty to the team doesn't exist past the fact that you lease this number. I mean, I guarantee somebody next year or even this year, J.J. Watt, I mean, what did he wear, 99?
Yeah. Right. Houston's going to retire his number.
Yeah, but somebody wore 99 this year at Houston.
I don't know. We're going to have to fact check that, Jacob.
I'm pretty sure that they gave it to just some no-name. Yeah, some no-name. That's what they do. If they're a great player, they give it to some, like, basically.
Well, maybe a great player, but not the greatest defensive end of all time.
He's pretty damn good. I'll give you that. J.J. Watt's a good player. I would have loved to have played against him. Who wore 99?
Nobody.
Not seeing it.
So they gave it to a guy on the practice squad. How great is that?
Allegedly.
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 Yeah.
Well, players can pick whatever numbers they want now, John. So defensive end, he was probably number one.
I hate that. I hate the fact that, like, I'm so used to the numbers being corresponding for positions. I hate it.
It makes the ref's job easier. I understand and I suppose Tom Brady had a big deal about it. But, yeah, if the refs their job is easier, the game is better. So
why do you think it makes the refs' job easier?
Well, it's like managing a weight room. We're scanning for change. We're scanning for deltas. So what hamstrings are off in a dead bug? So if I got to manage 60 dudes or 22 moving at the speed of light, I'm just scanning for deltas because those guys got to be on. And they can't make mistakes. I mean, we see what happens with the Saints in the playoffs every year. They get screwed over. So then the refs just get housed. But it decreases their margin for error.
I think it causes more margin of error because for so long, offensive line, like
tackle. We're on the same page.
Oh, yeah.
Changing the numbers increases the margin for error.
Yes, it dramatically. Like all of a sudden you see a guy get down to rush the passer wearing number one. Like, that should be, first of all, nobody should wear number one unless you're a punter or a kicker. It's ridiculous. But you get down and see a guy with single digits get down to 3-point. It's usually a safety, tight end, corner. That's not a defensive lineman. Like, it just, I don't know, dude.
Well, it becomes a pattern interrupt.
Yeah.
Right? And so the refs are looking for that pattern. With the
number 76 is eligible.
Right. Yeah. Had to do it. Mm-hmm. There's an old saying that age is wasted on the youth, or what is it? Youth is wasted on the young. I'm messing that one up. Youth is wasted.
Jacob looked that up.
Yeah.
But yeah, the number selection does play into a lot of what we're speaking about, and I'll call it the player empowerment era. It has ruined basketball for me personally, but I mean, you bitch and moan.
Youth is wasted on the young. I knew I had it right.
Yeah, but you bitch and moan. You want this, want that, and you're not willing to do the work, like, to equal the sacrifice of your wants. I mean, it goes to the individual running back, right? He worked up into the point, and then he gets paid, and then he stops to play.
I played with a running back like that. And they even called me in. You're going to laugh at this. The head coach called me in and asked me, hey, we're about to pay this dude. What do you think? And I said, I bet you the day you pay him, he'll never run for you again. And they, you know what they did? They paid him the next day. Mm-hmm. And you know what he did? He never ran again. Yeah. And it was a sad deal because a lot of guys got a big chip on their shoulder. And it's, you know, they somehow think that the money is what they've been working for in this. And I've long said that if money's the only reason you're out there, you're going to get exposed. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to, like, to get up and do it. I mean, obviously the money's important, but, like, you got to have, like, a pride about you. There has to be something more than just the cash. You got to go out and, like, you know, if you wouldn't go out and do it for free, you know, it doesn't make sense.
It has to be more than just an extrinsic motivation with the money, the cars, the girls, right? There has to be something intrinsically motivating you to go out there and perform that job, because as you know, it's fucking grueling.
Yeah.
Right? And so you have to have some determination, some motivation, something that's a fire inside of you that's pushing you each and every day.
So can you teach intrinsic motivation? And how do you present that to an athlete for them to find their own? So that way we don't present the want, we don't present the motivation for the coach.
Do you think it's possible for intrinsic motivation to be taught?
Yes, if the coach is able to meet them where they are. But this is the problem with a lot of high school level coaches, you know, football. But, and they speak on, like, this is the best time of your lives. This is, like, where you're going to peak. I don't know if they exactly say that, but, like, they put the pressure on them to succeed at this moment because this is the only time you'll have left. Versus asking and connecting where the athlete is. So that's the coach thinking, yeah. I had such a fucking cool life in high school. I didn't appreciate it when I was there. I'm forcing you to do so.
So are these coaches imprinting essentially their own past wishes on these athletes?
Oh, my God. And
then dude,
trauma.
They should probably do a screening for high school coaches. That the first question they ask him is this, like the Sigmund Freud, like laying on the couch, tell me about your mother. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your high school football experience. Because I really think, whether it be the parents, because, you know, my son's playing baseball right now. But what's wild is how invested these parents are, not because of the kids, but because it's allowing them to, you know, relive something. Mm-hmm. And talking to a lot of parents, like they didn't get to have the sport experience that they wanted. That's like a really interesting piece. Like talking to these parents, we go to some parties, we rap with them. Like their sporting experience, every single one of them got cut before they were ready to go it. And I feel the same way. Like I felt like my career got cut before I was ready to give it up too. But like I also got to do it in my 30s, not into my teens. So I mean, a lot of what parents and I think what these coaches, they come into it with like this idea, you know, and it's so stupid to me that you're going to have a coach be like, this is the best time in your life. And it's like, how do you know? I might go be a billionaire and make YouTube videos. Right. Like, how are you going to tell me this is the best time of my life? Like, and on top of it, these kids don't have the wherewithal or the intellectual, emotional capacity to even understand what that means.
Well, I think most don't. And so they become very impressionable at that point. And then the coaches are essentially, I think, stealing that youth away from them. At that point as well, because how many of these kids are really even have aspirations to go to a next level? I would say most of them, most don't.
Yeah. Small percentage to play at the next level.
How many, you know, you're in a kind of an interesting place with lacrosse in that it's a club sport and it's really, I mean, it's not like we're East Coast. I mean, lacrosse is relatively new here in Texas and these kids are right. So, I mean, you know, you have the wherewithal of having coached in played and coached in college, and you understand that, like, you know, there's a whole other world outside of Texas for these kids if they embrace lacrosse. And I'd love to say, I mean, we're, you know, just like if my brothers were sitting here, I got a chance to go to Berkeley because I played football. You know, I don't know about Marymount, but I mean,
oh, I couldn't got it in there.
Yeah,
like I only applied to one school.
You got in to play lacrosse.
Oh yeah.
My older brothers who went to the Claremont schools, they got in to play football. So I mean, as I've told a lot of people, sports, football, whatever it is, has got us a lot of places that normally we wouldn't have been able to get. But also, you know, I don't know if that like going to college and. If that's like the traditional, I mean, that traditional route is still the accepted route as most kids today. I mean, I can't imagine.
Well, football is different. Mm-hmm. So football, you can get a full ride, similar to what we learned from Zach Deschamps on TCU baseball. Baseball has 11.7 scholarships for their team, so they're able to spread 11 scholarships over the team of 30 baseball guys. Now, the objective is to find really smart guys that don't have to waste a scholarship on because we can get them in on academics. Vanderbilt, TCU. So lacrosse, I think it's like 13.6 scholarships. So now if I get a scholarship to play Division I lacrosse, it's only going to be for $5,000 for X amount, but it's not a full ride. So now with that in taking that into consideration, my first question for a kid would be, what do you want to study? What do you want to learn?
Sure.
Do you have any vision for your career following this? Now let's try to find a school that lines that up, and we can leverage lacrosse to get you into the school.
Yeah.
Versus if you just want to go play, and there are plenty of dudes that do this. I want to go play Division I. Then they sit on the bench of a Maryland. They never get playing time. Or they could start at a lower level Division I and play 4 years and have an awesome career for the school. Maybe they don't make it to the tournament, but you get on the field.
Yeah.
And I'm in the opinion of just put me on the field,
yeah,
win or loss, and I'll do my best in that level of competition. So now that there's a level down, Division III or II, where they have amazing schools, and I can leverage sport to get into an MIT, a Division III school, Tufts. So everything in that Boston area is all D3. Not all of it, but majority of the good ones. So now I'm in a position to be somewhere because of sport that I wouldn't get into otherwise. Yeah. Vanderbilt's the ultimate example. Like, awesome school that is not on par with athletics except for baseball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Vandy's good on baseball.
Yeah, go get your dick kicked in football and walk away with a Vanderbilt degree. But now, how do I relay that message to the youth?
Well, they have to hear it from their parents. I mean, as a coach, I mean, you can only influence so much, and people fail at the margins of their experience. I think if you have, and you know, we run into this constantly as parents, where you're trying to influence your kids in a certain way, and you know, whether it, I mean, obviously we hope it's always positive, but, you know, there's a lot of shortcomings with parents. I mean, we were going to, you know, talk extensively today about helicopter parenting and a lot of this stuff that parents have effectively done that I call it demasculating the kids. And, you know, I'm going to use masculate because I, you know, obviously with boys, but even to girls, where we're not asking our kids to solve their own problems. We just helicopter in, solve their problem and pop out. And that's not doing anything to allow these kids to develop a structure to deal with their own problems, and more importantly, to adhere through adversity.
Well, yeah, they don't ever have an opportunity to fail and then learn from those experiences.
Yeah.
But then, if you look at this from another avenue, another path as well, it almost brings you down this interesting mindset. The kids don't really know what they want because they are always desiring then what the parents want for them.
Yeah.
And think about how that relates then later in life too. Like, you really don't know what you want in a career. So you just go and get a bunch of different random jobs until you eventually find something that you're okay settling with.
So you played
and relationships.
You
as
played
well.
Baseball in college, right?
No, just through high school.
Just through high school.
Mm-hmm. Just through high school.
Any desire to go play in college?
I did. Shoulder surgery though.
Well, so then did shoulder surgery spark your interest in physical therapy, which then helped guided your
That was a trajectory shift for me. But I also realized in high school, once that shoulder surgery stuff happened, that I was a much better coach and athlete, a much better provider than a player. I got way more enjoyment out of helping others succeed in the gym and watching that transfer out into the field or the court versus
even with those freakishly long arms.
Yeah, you know it. Yeah.
Dude, I'm just going to tell you, dude, the amount of mass you've put on in the forearms and the biceps, it's impressive.
How do you think I did that?
Hammer curls?
PG-13.
Lifting weights? Johnny Bod? I mean, I like came in today and like the arms were looking good. I'm like, dude, I didn't know if this was like more jiu-jitsu or more shooting or whatever.
I really do think a lot of it has to do with the goal of me doing a one-arm chin-up. Been doing a lot of pulling, so a lot of grip intensive work.
I like it.
A lot of grip intensive work. And then being on the hands and the handstand positions as well.
Yeah.
Having to stabilize all those little accessory muscles around the elbows, it just blew up.
Yeah.
Stabilize the joint. Yeah.
Tex is, you've spent the last couple of years, obviously coaching this. And it's not an obscure sport, but in Texas it is an obscure sport.
Oh, it's obscure for Texas.
So, but the interesting thing is, which I'm kind of shocked with, is the interaction between the team, the coach, the player, and the parent. It would be a little bit different. Like, for example, like my son decides to go play football and he's out there playing or something's happening. Having an intrinsic knowledge of not only offenses and defenses and all these other players, I can assess pretty quickly whether or not the coach knows what the fuck he's doing. Mm-hmm. But, also having been on that side, I don't know if helicopter parenting in and trying to insert myself and work all this stuff, that doesn't benefit anybody. That only goes poorly for the kid. But what I find even more interesting is, within your situation, there's a good chance that none of these parents have ever picked up a lacrosse stick. So like it'd be a little bit different if you were on in Maryland, for example, and the lacrosse coach was fucking up and it just so happened that a kid's playing, both of his parents were all Americans, and they're like, hey, I played this game since I was a seed. This is what they're doing.
Thoughts on that? It's a club sport, so you pay to play. So it's different than football, baseball, basketball, volleyball, etc., which is affiliated with the school. So now they feel they are entitled to have an opinion on the direction of the program, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. The same is sought out with club sports, club volleyball. Parents are the same way. I mean, they're watching the club practices. They're putting their fingers into the experience of the team. So I think it's just at the club level, club soccer, volleyball, all of those are huge and still dealing with the same challenges. Unfortunately. So I think it's that it's a sense of entitlement. Since I write you a check, I can tell you what to do. Rather than, I'm a UIL sport, I'll sign up for football, we'll see what happens, And then the parents, they should sit back. I don't know. But then, and I know this from politics of high school football in Texas, there's boosters. So you still do fundraising. And then the fundraisers from my high school experience, they made sure that their senior and their sophomore son got to play together and be on the same varsity team together. So, what did they buy? A new mat for the baseball team, so that a new tarp to cover out with rain. So we'll buy this tarp, but I need to make sure that my boys play together.
It's like a quid pro quo.
Oh, yeah. Dude. Yeah. These people, obviously, I didn't grow up in that situation.
So it still exists at the UIL.
Yeah.
Through boosters.
I just didn't. Yeah, no, that's not how shit worked.
You follow the money with anything, it'll take you back to the true source of the funding that directs the decision making.
I just can't imagine. I mean, I think I might have told you my high school coach didn't like me very much. I came like so.
Mine either. If he put me in, man, we would have won state.
Well, I mean, I started both ways, and I know he didn't like me because he told me as much. But he also couldn't keep me off the field because I was one of the best players. So he did some other little bullshit things, but I circumvented him. Smarter than him at that, even at that age, which I like to believe. But I really think too that if you've done the work, you've trained hard, and you go out there and you're the best player, I'd like to hope that you get a chance to play. But it doesn't always feel like that.
Well, even at the NCAA. So NCAA had a campaign years ago that everybody goes pro in something other than sports, like something along that tagline. Mm-hmm. So this is for all the NCAA athletes, like motivating to turn your sport into like scholarly success with the realization that, hey, you're going to play this and you're not going to go pro.
Yeah.
So now I mean, that advertisement campaign spoke to me, because now you realize, like, especially lacrosse ended at college back when I was in college. Now there's Premier League, but...
Well, I mean, when you were coming out of high school and you picked go there, I mean, you were going to play lacrosse.
Oh, there's no way I was going to be professional.
No, like, I know, but you knew that, but you were using it as a springboard to get where you needed to go.
Yes. Yeah. And
same shit my brothers did.
Yeah. Yeah, and I knew I didn't want the traditional Texas, we call Texas Tech, 13th grade, Taylor Tech, Katie Taylor. So I didn't want that experience.
Yeah.
I wanted to play ball somewhere.
And well, then, it sounds like that was enough motivation for you to shift your trajectory.
Yeah, but yeah.
Well, that could be an intrinsic motivation too.
Oh, there was plenty of intrinsic motivation.
Well, what was your intrinsic motivation?
Well, my coach, I had two coaches in college. My initial coach, plenty of stories about him, but he arranged roommates. So all the freshmen coming in according to his top recruit and his bottom recruit. So I was paired up with the top recruit. So now...
Are you saying you were the bottom?
Oh, yeah. No doubt, dude. You barely catch and throw. It's just I used my head as a weapon. I played the sport differently.
Well, then how did you get there?
Because he wanted a bruiser. He needed a goon.
So he won. Oh, so...
Yeah, I got more career knockouts than goals.
Hey, coach, I got the foil on my knuckles.
Coach.
Coach, put me in. I got foil on my knuckles.
Hansons were a big motivator. But that
you know, that's still one of my favorite movies.
It's great.
Yeah.
Paul Newman.
Have you guys ever seen Slapshot? It's fucking the best.
Yeah. But that he was playing a lot of those mind games with the team. And we all came together as a team to hate him. So I learned a lot in that respect.
I'm not mad at him for doing, I mean, did he do it on purpose?
100%.
He's like, you know what?
At the same time, I'm not going to give too much away on this guy. But I'm sure you can look it up. But he started as a freshman in his college career, Division I. Then they lost the championship. So he started freshman, sophomore, junior year. And then his senior year, a freshman came in and stole his job from him. So for his whole coaching career, it was always about you got to work harder, you got to do this. And then like pitting players against each other and just as super fucked up as he is in the head, trying to push that on us. And I'm very observant. So... saw all these things. It's not dissimilar from what I experienced at Texas high school football, mm-hmm. but the rest of my team, they had never felt the trauma of a coach just being poured out onto them. I had plenty of experience
coaching
with this.
Scars.
Oh yeah, so plenty of experience, and I joined the cross country team. I did everything I could to make the team and have an impact. So joined cross country freshman year to be in good enough shape to play lacrosse. So, like, I was willing to make the sacrifices that other people were not willing to because it was just the way for me through, you know, football and track and just the way it is in Katy anyway. But
Well, think about that from a psychological perspective, too. Essentially, what that coach was doing was instilling a lot of fear into everybody because fear is a really strong emotion. It's a really great motivator. But as you can probably attest to, it affects everybody differently.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oh. So it is either going to turn like we have a go switch and a stop switch in the body. Right. The sympathetic, parasympathetic type of a drive. And I think I don't know if you can train this in people. Maybe you can elude this a little bit more. But I think it affects some people differently where it just shuts them down. And others, they can harness that energy and actually use it kind of like you did to motivate you for
tackle
good.
And fuel.
Yeah.
Bobby Boucher, tackle and fuel.
Oh, yeah.
Fear is a incredible motivator for me. Mm-hmm. Like the fear of loss, the fear of not being good enough, the fear of mm-hmm. failure. I have never felt crippled. So like, I'll just give you an example. Like people go to a haunted house and they get super scared. And they like, there was a huge haunted house in Kansas City that was like the scariest place on the planet.
Well, what about that prison in Philly?
Oh yeah. Well, that's a second. Well, that's scary. That's
my also, cousin lives right there.
Yeah. It's called
Pennhurst. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give you a little bit of history. We'll take a 2 second deviation on this, behind this story. So Pennhurst was an insane asylum mm-hmm. in downtown Philly. And the way the story goes, Pennhurst was built and you obviously know Operation, was it Paperclip? I'll have to look this one up, where they basically brought over a bunch of Nazi scientists and gave them jobs here.
I know what you're referring to, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's that called? Operation Paperclip might have been...
Nazis, Philadelphia.
No, just Nazi scientists to the U.S.
We're just
Hold on.
Putting Jacob on the FBI watch list real quick.
You've now become a domestic terrorist. Congratulations.
Yeah. Operation Paperclip.
There it is.
So Operation Paperclip brought in, the CIA basically brought in 1,600 German scientists to come into the United States. One of the guys who was like Mendeleev's like right hand, they brought him and he was in charge of Pennhurst and continued his research on the people that were brought to the mental hospital. Mm-hmm. So the atrocities that were committed there are of like legend, and they pretty much just shut it down and like walked away and shut the door. And then these people, I mean, it's one of the most haunted places. Whenever they show like the ghost catchers and all this wacky shit, it's always there. They did a haunted house and you could walk That's through creepy. It.
Yeah.
I'm still getting like goosebumps thinking about it because you're like, it looks like something that was created for like terror. But I was going to say that there was this really like warehouse that they would do this haunted house in Kansas City, and they would make you sign a release because people had like from the fear would go comatose and just lock up and fall down. And they had stretchers and gurneys and they had ambulance. And I just thought it was for show. And I was like, what is this bullshit? Are we going to get attacked in here? Are we going to fight? What's going on? And they're like, no, it's so frightening. And people get so scared that they go comatose and we'll have people fall over a couple times a night. And then we have to wheel them out and then, basically revive them. I have, fear does nothing for me in that way. Mm-hmm. Like, I think sometimes, fear for some people is disabling. Like, it doesn't affect me in anything. I wonder if that's, wiring. Maybe that was, early exposure to things. I don't know. But, for a lot of people, fear is crippling. Mm-hmm. It doesn't affect me that same way.
Well, I think we're all a product of our environment, right? And how we were raised. And we don't, I don't have kids. You do. But as parents, we're always going to fuck up our kids in some way. You have no idea how it's going to work.
God damn it.
I know.
This is the paradox of parenting. You tried to do your best. You hope to do your best. Sure. But you don't know what you say or what you do,
correct.
Something that might just seem like innocuous and I might just say off the cuff becomes a serious crutch in my kids' minds.
Mm-hmm. No, what I was going to go on to after that is that's a big reason why fear is such a big motivator for me too, because my dad instilled that fear into me from an early age, and like the fear of disappointment, right? And so that was a huge one for me. I think that's kind of why I'm so successful with what I'm doing now, is I never wanted to disappoint others around me, so I won't let it happen. And then internally, you don't want to disappoint yourself. Like, I was a fat kid growing up until I reached junior year of high school, and I was made fun of a lot for it. And that's why I found the weight room.
Yeah.
And that transitioned to your compliment to me on my arms. But that's why I started lifting heavy weights, because it changed my physique and it changed
and modeling. Model.
Yeah.
Idiot.
Is it? I don't know where I would be if I hadn't have found the weight room.
Same.
I to this day, and I'm going through this right now. What's that? You rolled your eyes at me.
No, I just remembered a quote from Old School. Right at the end, Frank the Tank. He's like, "Yeah, without the Godfather, I don't know where I'd be right now. Probably face down, lying in a pool somewhere."
Yeah, well, it's a true statement. I'm going through this with my nephew. My nephew is 17 years old. Never really got into the gym. He's 6'1", 6'2", 170 pounds, super skinny. And he, plays baseball. Now all of a sudden he's in an issue where the other kids are getting bigger. Now they're like 200, 210, and they're throwing harder. And they're like, you're technically real sound. You're a good player, but you're not throwing as hard as you need. You need to get bigger and stronger. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden he reaches out and he's like, "I need to get bigger and stronger. What do I do?" I'm like, "I just so happen to know a dude." But the interesting thing is my older brother knows this. Mm-hmm. Like, my brother is by far my greatest influence and the greatest coach. I'm like, Luke sent me all of his meal logs and this, and mm-hmm. he's been training. And so I got to go back and kind of put some stuff together for him. But I got to call my brother and be like, "What are you doing? You know how to get people big. Dude, we did it every single day." And when I've talked to him about it, he's like, my brother, I don't know if he's interested in pushing him the same way he pushed me. And he's like, "He's real smart. That might be a different path for him." And I was like, "So what? My path was what? To put my head down and smash?" He's like, "Yeah, we were rockheads. That's how we did it." He's like, he has something else that we didn't. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that, like maybe kids give you a different perception, mm-hmm. but now it's on me. And I told him, I was like, hey, dude, by this time next year, you got to be 200 pounds. He's like, I don't know if I can be 200 pounds. I'm like, you're going to eat like you are. Mm-hmm. And we're going to pack it on. And you're going to go lift some weights and you're going to do some classic bodybuilding. Because he sent me a video of what he and his friends were doing for lifting weights. And I'm like, that's not lifting weights.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this question, though. Is your brother still like actively training?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
My brother's like, he's still probably one of the best athletes I've ever been around. Like my brother, when he was a kid, he was a real good tennis player.
Yeah.
He was Pete Sampras's doubles partner. Right. And then he got in and then we got to high school and only, DBs.
Soft language, please.
Yeah. Only DBs, only, wimps played tennis.
Yeah.
And so of course all the cool guys play football. So, Chris has heard me tell the story before. That's why he's trying to soften the language a little bit. Now, remind you, this is the 80s, so there's a whole different vernacular for this one. So, he does. What does he do is he quits tennis and goes and plays football and starts lifting weights and getting bigger and stronger. Well, he should have just kept playing tennis because he's really good. So about maybe 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, he's like, hey, I think I'm going to go my brother's wife started playing tennis. And he's like, oh, I'll go. I used to play tennis when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So he went out and she was getting like a lesson from some pro. And he's like, oh, it's my husband. And he like picks up a racket and just kind of like starts hitting with the guy. And like the pro is kind of hitting back. And Eddie like just like starts just hammering the dude. And the dude's like, oh, let's serve a little bit. Ed like aced him like 5 times. And the guy's like, dude, you're a pretty good tennis player. He's like, well, do you play pretty recently? He's like, I've been playing like maybe 30 years. I was pretty good when I was a kid. The guy's like, what are you talking about? So then Eddie enters a tournament. And like wins like the over 40 Orange County title. Wow. And so he's like played football, walked on and played baseball and started on his baseball team in college. I mean, Eddie's always been a great athlete. So, but we were always, we trained. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's the one that taught me how to play football. He came home every summer and we trained. So it's interesting that, my nephew, who's a good baseball player and, needs to be big and strong, so I'll help him do it. But, I always think for myself, I was lucky I had mentors. Mm-hmm. And I even told my mom the other day, we were laughing about something about George Zangas. And my mom was kind of getting in because she got a little feisty on Zangas a few times. And I was like, George was great. For all of his shortcomings and whatnot, he brought on and mentored a bunch of kids that were just trying to get big and strong, and he was able to collect them and instill through that deal.
So instill is a word I want to hold on to. So now we need to differentiate wanting it for someone, but then instilling the belief that they can do it. So with Luke, Ed wants him to put on weight. He wants him to unlock his genetic potential of musculature that is in there. And then now you're instilling it. You're going to be, dude, you're going to be 200 pounds.
Yeah.
You can do this.
Well,
so that's important to differentiate. And now if we're applying this as a coach, it's, you're not forcing the want, the hard work, because the kids will reject that and then do the exact opposite of what you versus you have the potential. Or reinforcing the behaviors of showing up on time, working hard, and over time start to create the possibility to play at the next level or the possibility to compete on your city stage. But it's not wanting it for and then holding that against them. It's acknowledging the behavior that they're doing and instilling that. Yes, you're going to have to eat more. However, you crush that meal. So we're just going to add one more tablespoon of peanut butter the next time, whatever. Versus,
I ate every, and you're going to laugh at this, I ate every single meal from the time I was 14 till I was in my early 30s. So it was over 16, 17, 18 years, right? Mm-hmm. So 14 to probably 32. I ate every single meal as if it was going to be my last meal to the point where I felt like I was going to get sick. I would like eat and then just be like, oh, I think I'm going to throw up. Like every meal. So what's so liberating today is I'll sit down and be like, I'm still kind of hungry. I don't think I'm going to eat anymore. And then like what's hilarious too is I'll slip into it. All of a sudden I'll like start eating and I'll be like, oh, I can just get one more bite in. I can go one more bite. And then like I have this like internal thing with myself where like if I get too full, I'll be like, God damn it. Why did you do that? And it's like trying to like break this like mindset of overeating.
it's an ingrained pattern within you.
Oh my God.
Right. I think that's our job as coaches though, too. Like, and I believe even as a physical therapist, I'm primarily a coach as well. And like our main job is to help people get someplace that they want to go. Like we're their guide along the way. And one of those things we have to do is be able to show them what's possible. I think a lot of that has to be done through the means of questioning and answering, right? So figuring out what the layers are and peeling them back. Because when I get people that are in pain, getting out of pain is not the ultimate goal, right? There's always something underneath that that is driving them forward. And that's that internal motivation. It's the same thing with your nephew, yes? Mm-hmm. Like what's the underlying goal other than just putting on 200 pounds? Like what does that get you? What can you do with that?
I think he wants to throw harder.
Yeah.
I really think there's such a short time period, you know, and sport's so important. And I realize you can play these sports all your life, but there's such a, I saw something the other day, which kind of like almost made me tear up a little bit, but like, it was like, man, there was a, like, do you remember the last time you went out to go ride your bikes with your buddies or the last time, you know, you stepped on a football field? And it was kind of like just talking about like, the realization that like there were moments like you only get to go to four proms, you only got to do this like so many times, like there was a last day that you played one-on-one basketball or mm-hmm. There was last for all these. And the problem is as a kid and when you're young, you don't realize that that's the last until mm-hmm. it's passed. And so I think at least with high school sports, we see a lot of times with these parents where, you know, they're coming out and they're trying to relive something or right some wrong that was wrong done. I wasn't as good as I needed to be, so I'm going to make sure that my kid doesn't know that pain. But yeah, it's just so happened that that experience shaped you for who you are today. So like, why would you want to take that from somebody else? Or the idea that I want to make sure that, oh my God, can you hear it? That's the Tabata flu. Coming back, I did some Tabatas on the Echo Bike and I have the flu. But there's this desire to change, to try to rewrite history, to right a wrong. I don't think you can do it. I think all you can do is provide the opportunity and allow them to go out and do their best. And they have to make their own way in this life.
Yes. And we had our first ever intern experience that. He was successful athletically, academically, and never saw failure. Until
until he came to Power Athlete?
Until he became an intern with Power Athlete. And everything you're doing is wrong. I want you to know this. Oh, my God.
When he told me that, my head almost popped off.
He was having a real hard time.
Yeah. That, like, the fact that everything he'd done in his life was perfect. He had always been successful. Yeah. And said that this is the first time he'd never been good at anything. Mm. In an internship. I was like, holy shit. I've sucked at a lot of stuff.
Yeah, oh. I've sucked at everything.
Yeah.
I still suck at a lot.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Jeff Gonzalez made me realize that really quick at a shooting course. That I'm like, yep, I suck at this really bad. Yeah.
We've all taken Jeff's course, and he makes it look so seamless and effortless. Uh-huh. Especially when we're shooting at those, like, four, what were they, 20 or 40 yards? Like, we're
25.
Yeah. 20. At the 25.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't hit anything.
Like, and, oh, how many of those under white?
Yeah, and then he's like, well, you got a... That's a DQ. It was funny. We were texting back and forth the other day, and I was talking about the course, and I was like, yeah, I mean, the fact that you were able to get text proficient with a pistol in 2 days, he's like, yeah, he took it like just like a fish to dirt. Just funny.
I got an 11. My final score is 11 out of 100.
I've tripled yours, though.
Yeah, Zan's got a 30.
Everybody fails.
Everybody fails.
Everybody fails. And the only people that don't fail have been to his course numerous times. So there's people that, when I went to his course in LA, there were people there that, like, their whole mission in life was to somehow get Jeff's approval mm-hmm. by passing his course.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's plenty of athletes like that. Oh, I've witnessed that, especially when we travel the road and the world and work with a lot of different athletes, seeing that they want to impress us one way or another. Mm-hmm. That I never got over. It's like, dude, yeah. Just do your best, and there's always room. I will find something wrong with you.
Well, I think the only thing that impresses me is effort.
Behaviors. So then behaviors we can reinforce, but then there's always something to find in terms of movement and performance that can level up. So if you're willing to accept the one direction, the one cue, the 1% better that we can make you, that impresses me versus fighting and striving for perfection. And then as soon as we give you a correction,
yeah,
body language, head down, slouching.
I think that's a level of humility that not a lot of people have too. So, you know, your intern that was perfect at everything,
mm-hmm.
that level of perfectionism comes off as like overly cocky, I think, in a way too. But I think there's a fine line between.
Yes, maybe for that.
Sure.
But then there's also individuals that have limited self-confidence. So as soon as they make one mistake, then they disappear up their own asshole. Mm-hmm. So that's different than the intern that we had, who was a perfectionist. It's just, you really have to work hard to level them up. And fear is not going to work for them because they will just disappear and you'll lose them for an entire game, practice, season.
I think it's important to define that in athletes though too, because I think the distinguishing factor with the cockiness and the confidence piece and humility is like, to me anyway, like I could be confident in a lot of areas of my life because I know I'm fucking good at it, you know? Like,
yeah,
but there's other areas though I think you can become too cocky in, and that distinguishing factor is like, you're putting yourself up on this level where you're not really at.
But that's false hubris or
sure.
that's bravado.
Sure.
I wrote about that in my 42 things that what gives you confidence is knowing you've done the work.
Also.
So if you've done the work and you've trained harder than anybody else and you've like put in more effort than any human being to ever mm-hmm. walk this earth, you have the right to beat your chest
absolutely.
A little bit. The problem is there's kind of an interesting like the false bravado part is always very fascinating to me, where I hear people that are extremely confident and I'm like, are they confident because they're the best in the world because they've done the work, or is it false bravado because they're trying to convince somebody else of something?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a little bit of that, but I think the way that you can parse that out is through results. There's data, right? Are you actually producing results? Yes or no? If you are, then I think you do have a right to be confident
yeah.
in that area. But if you're not, what evidence do you have? Right. And that's where I think people sniff that out really quickly. And that's where the lack of trust and lack of confidence in that coach or in that provider comes. They don't believe in you. Because
this is an interesting thing that's fascinated me forever, especially with coaches and like, you know, what you're doing in terms of a PT, and you take the position of being a coach. Where does the lack of confidence come from? Like, Chris, like you're coaching your athletes, you're on the ball, they're in, they feel that what you're doing is increasing performance, you're getting people out of pain, they're moving better, and then all of a sudden they like lose confidence in you. Like, why do they lose confidence? Or more importantly, what happens where now all of a sudden the person who was, you know, the person shepherding them across to help them no longer becomes the person that can do it?
I think for me personally, at least what I see in the physical therapy coaching space, is that there is mismanaged expectations from the get-go, right? So you see this a lot in the PT world, where there's a lot of quick fix mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, I've got these hands of God that can take away your pain with whatever type of, you name it, dry needling technique or manipulation or whatever that you can do. And then we devise this narrative or this story around it that allows that client or that athlete to buy into it in the moment. And there is like a voodoo essence to it, or there's a magic trick of, yes, you can take the pain away, and that is enough to motivate somebody to help them feel confident. But the key factor here is that what happens later on down the road, right? Are we still running through this vicious cycle because we never actually got to the source of the problem to begin with? And I think that comes down to these expectations that we set in the beginning and clear, confident communication through that experience. Because if you set the expectation that, hey, you just need to come to me every time you're in pain and remove it, there's no responsibility, there's no accountability, there's no autonomy there. They have now become dependent on you. And it's like this weird codependent relationship where the athlete or client needs you to take their pain away, and then you need that client to feel good about yourself because you are able to take that pain away, versus setting the expectations at the beginning of like, hey, I know I can help you feel better in this moment, but here's the problem and here's the game plan that we're going to take to move through it. And you're going to have ups and downs because life is messy. The human body is super complex and nothing is ever cut and dry. And I think if you give them that expectation in the beginning, you can then help navigate those waters when you come to those bumps in the road, because it's bound to happen. You're going to be 6-8 weeks down the road and your back might start hurting again. But instead of now spiraling down because of the fact that you're in pain again. Now you say, well, he didn't do his job.
Yeah.
I don't trust him anymore. He couldn't do it. He's not the guy.
Yeah.
Versus setting the expectation at the beginning of that's going to happen. Now you have like a mutual understanding because, I mean, communication was clear from the get-go. It was clear in the beginning.
Yeah. And certain sports have failure built into it. Baseball. Mm-hmm. If you hit 30%, you are good.
Yeah, you're going to the Hall of Fame.
You're going to, maybe not, maybe. But, and then the expectation of a goalie for lacrosse, looking at Jacob over there, if you let in 10 goals, we still got a chance to win. Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. So now there's certain expectations with failure associated with them in certain positions in sports that are not. So it's built into some sports expectation, and do coaches do a good job to nurture that expectation of failure and reinforce when something well is done? Or if you give up a sack or you get pushed back, do they just fucking motherfuck you?
Yes.
And ignore the 10 good plays that you just made?
100%.
Everybody always remembers.
Now,
I could win
at
on
a developmental level versus the professional level. I get it at the pros, but now we're talking developmental.
Yeah, no, I was like that my entire life. Mm-hmm. I was a sum of all the bad things I've ever done. And it's extremely hard because then you end up reflecting back and only remembering all of the bad plays. And so what's crazy is I saw, it was on TV, there was a bunch of, or I think somebody forwarded me some clips, or I can't remember what it was from, but it was pretty recent. And as soon as I saw the play line up, I knew exactly what I did. And I knew because I fucked up on that play. And there was like a run play. This guy beat me across the face. I pushed him. The running back cut back, and we had a huge run. Like, we had a huge run because the gap was there because the guy cross-faced me, and I didn't do what I was supposed to do. I was athletic enough and lucky enough to push him out of the way. The back read it perfectly and cut back, and we had a huge run. And they're showing this highlight of this dude, and I'm just like, I can remember being in my stance and seeing the dude cross-face me and not, and basically crossing over and not getting there in time, pushing him with everything I had, and thank God the running back cut back for that play.
And those details are so clear and vivid, aren't they? Because our brain is wired for negative emotions. Yeah. It was a survival mechanism.
Well, and then all of a sudden I watched the next clip, and I totally murdered the dude. I had no recollection of that play. I took the guy, literally zone step, drove him off the ball, and pancaked the dude like 4 yards downfield. And like we had a great run. I didn't remember that play at all. And I'm like, what? And I'm like, God. Like the only thing, the only space in my head is for the failures. Mm-hmm. And it's awful. It's what I live with every single day of my life. And I wish, you know, that's why I always think when we had Judd on the podcast and he's like, you can do this app again and it'll clear everything. And then all of a sudden you'll imprint. I'm like, maybe it could get rid of all the negatives in my life. And I think it's fascinating for that piece, but it's really shitty to, just kind of remember only the negatives. I mean, I read a thing that I think the average person says somewhere between like 2,500 and 5,000 negative things to themselves every single day. Hmm. And like, you know, like the, you know, don't talk about your bad about yourself or the warrior within will start to believe Mushiashi. I mean, it's pretty interesting.
Again, problem that's been around for thousands of years and we're still fighting through it. Yeah.
In sport, and I asked Matt that same question. Like, how do you, like, what's the moment? Like, what do you think? I mean, he brought it up, said managing expectations. You know, you bring the person in, you're helping them, everything looks great, and then all of a sudden it reverts, and you haven't managed that expectation. What do you think
on
your side?
But this, and what you're speaking to, this is the value of sport. This is why all kids need sport. And there's a fantastic statistic. I can't remember it, but it's like 60 to 70% of kids stop playing sport at 9 years old. Mm-hmm. But they need to, because this essentially is the safest arena for them to fail and then get feedback. Otherwise, where do they fail? In the classroom, which truly has an impact on their future, or with alcohol, or with drug experimentation, or with sex. So those all have consequences that are real.
Life-changing consequences.
Now, sport is a place where we can fall down and get back up. We can give up a bad play and then line up the next opportunity. I can strike out, and I know 8 dudes later, I'm going to get my shot again. If it's lacrosse, I just gave up a goal. Okay, face it off. Let's go again. So it's the area, the most important time and opportunity that we have to learn how to fail, to bounce back, to communicate, to take coaching and feedback and direction. And this is what pisses me off with parents, is they are interfering and fucking it up. So at 11 years old, about when you hit 7th grade, 11, 12, 13, partnership with sport. So, John, you're experiencing this with Cassius Baseball. You're taking him to sport. You're sitting there. You're forced to watch the games. I know, I'm just making fun there. But, like, you're watching the games, and at 11, 12 years old, you're going to hand him off to middle school sport, and now it's a professional coach, and your responsibility is to sit in right field with the other dads and just be out of earshot for what you truly want to say. So he can take responsibility for his own actions, and whether he chooses to work hard or not, it's still on him. And then dad can help shape and craft those lessons and do your damnedest as a father and leader. But at the same time, Cash has got to make those mistakes.
Well, I've taken the approach that example is the best form of leadership. And with my kids, with everything, you know, be the change you want to see in this world. Mm-hmm. So whether it be, you know, like I had an interesting conversation with my mom, and she's like, you know, you guys are so, I can't say this universally, but you guys are so much more engaged with your kids than we were as parents. She's like, your dad basically worked. And she's like, do you remember seeing him? I'm like, not unless we were on the weekends. Like, my dad didn't become super involved in my life until, like, high school and college and much later. And he's like, yeah, because you guys weren't interesting to him at the time. And I'm like, really? She's like, you know, your dad worked. He worked his job. He ran for city council. He ran for Congress. He did all these things that he wanted to do, coaching you or coming home. Like, he just had things that he wanted. He still had dragons to slay, and he wasn't willing to, like, push them aside to, like, you know, come home every night and coach your guys' sports. And it wasn't until later on that you guys became really good that he became much more. And he did. He, like, when I went to the NFL, he went to a ton of my games. But, you know, she's like, the fact that, you know, you've go enroll and do jujitsu so that Jamie could do it, and you guys did it together. She's like, did your dad do that when you did martial arts? She's like, no, I had to drop you guys off. And she's like, you guys are just, it's a different time. Mm-hmm. Like, you guys have taken upon yourself to, like, lead your children by example, where she's like, you like, when we had kids, kind of the mindset was like, oh, you know, like, here are these parents, you're living your life, and then you kind of add kids. She's like, you guys are so much more involved, which is kind of true in a lot of ways. You know, we were just much more proactive, just, I don't know, I mean, just how it works today than it probably did then, so.
But there's still going to be a point where you hand off the girl's performance to a pro.
100%. But what they've done is that you learn hard work, dedication, and effort. You learn all those things, not from a coach. You learn it because this is who your parent is, and these are the people that have raised me, because this is the accepted form of effort that you work forward. Like, my parents worked hard. Like, my dad got up every morning, busted his ass, same with my mom. And, like, I learned all of that. Like, this is what you have to do for success.
So that's an example. You took and owned that experience, but then, and this is me coaching experience, there's a lot of dudes that don't have dads. There's a lot of kids that are adopted. So they don't have those examples, and they come from some different places. So then it is a responsibility of the coach. Yeah. And this is where I'm stealing Jim Davis's line, but I believe it wholeheartedly, that coaches teach lessons. Sports don't teach lessons.
Yeah.
So now that is an example. Then I can understand that as a coach, that what was very beneficial for John to lead to a very impactful professional career, lessons he learned from his dad. Fortunate to get to interview him, but then now I can help lead those lessons, because some dudes on teams that I coach, they don't have fathers.
Yeah.
What I love about what you guys are both talking about right now, that performance that you're referring to, whether it be performance out on the field for a sport or performance in life when it comes to relationships and business, it's all built on a foundation of resiliency, right? And where do you build that resiliency at? For me, you know, you brought up this idea of it's not Jim Davis's line of it's the coach, not the sport, that's helping instill those lessons. And I think that that's true. And also your parents, you know, the influences from mentors and parents is super substantial. Where I still vividly remember this line from my dad, the decisions I was making as a kid, he would let me make them on my own, but he would always tell my mom, just let him go. He's either going to sink or he's going to swim.
Yeah.
Right. And so that line has always been in my brain, and that helped formulate this resiliency moving forward into sport. And then why I'm successful now is because of that moment right there. And it's, can you apply that then in other areas of your life? Is it replicable? Mm-hmm. Right? Do you have that foundation? And I think that's why it's a shame that a lot of kids are getting out of sports so young, because they're missing out on that opportunity to build that foundational resiliency that's going to help them later in life. And maybe that would help prevent a lot of the issues that we're currently dealing with now in society.
Well, is it shitty parents or is it shitty coaches? Yeah. Or a little combination of both? Well, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, like if you don't have a parent or you don't have a good coach, you know, is that literally the limiting factor? I mean, I don't feel like I had good high school football coaches. I don't feel like I, you know, I mean, probably the best football coach I had was probably my freshman year of high school. We had a badass coach. And then even my sophomore year, the coaches we had were badass. When I got to varsity, I did not have good coaches. Actually, I had one good, our offensive line coach, a guy named Dwayne Lyons, was a badass from Texas. And he actually believed in me as a player where other people didn't. But I wouldn't say that like any one of those people took me aside mm-hmm. and was like, hey, man, if you do this, you will go on and play for a long time. If anything, it was probably my friend Tasso Papadakis and being around those guys that instilled confidence because he could do it. So mm-hmm. I just think if you let's say you had a shitty high school football coach and you don't have a parent, like who's the person that helps you persevere, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I think every scenario is different.
Well, I think that you can, you know, the whole influenced by the five people you're surrounding yourself, the closest people. Yeah. I think there's a lot to that because a lot of the lessons that I learned is I put myself into rooms and around people that were either A, a lot smarter than me or B, a lot bigger and stronger than me. Right. And I got a great example of a story. I was with my, one of my Olympic athletes up in Fort Worth a couple of weeks ago, and he's my age, he's 34. And then we had a young kid, 18 years old, Skeeter, that was working with us. And I programmed a workout with heavy sled pushes in there. Right. And so we're throwing on the weight, and it got to the point where we were jumping on the sleds. So my 215-pound ass and then the Olympic athlete, he was about 190, and this 18-year-old kid who maybe weighs a buck 40 soaking wet had to push us. And in that moment, he was able to overcome adversity and build that resiliency because he couldn't move it. Right, so we had to get off and like kind of give him a little bit of an assistance, but then he got it moving and it kind of helped build that confidence. And that's where I told him, like, this is where you're going to improve, is putting yourself into these situations where there's people around you that are bigger, they're stronger, and that's how you're going to get there as well, because you have that environment, that influence.
And that's that. This leads us back to the weight room, of course. Why the weight room was beneficial for all three dudes at this table is because it is, you know, there's no politics in the weight room. Mm-hmm. 225 is 225, to quote Henry Rollins. So if you do put in the
200
work,
pounds is 200 pounds.
I thought it was 225.
No, it's 200 pounds is 200 pounds.
You know better than I. But then 200 pounds is 200 pounds. The work, the effort, everything that you pour in will appear within your coordination, your body, your structure. So that's the beauty of the weight room and the opportunity there to, you know, 200 pounds is 200 pounds. It's you versus the barbell. It's you versus yourself. It's not influenced by anyone else. And you can determine the confidence that you gain because you lifted that barbell or you lifted that tire. You did it. And you can own that no matter what somebody says on the internet. Like, you still move the weight, move the dirt.
Well, that's
a good way to end it right there, yeah?
Yeah, no, I think. Yeah,
nice mic drop moment.
No, it's it's about effort. You know, it's about providing leadership and providing people an environment to succeed. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be both negative and positive in that a lot of times with coaches and parents, they fall at the margins of their experience, and a lot of what they're pushing on either their athletes or their children is their own shortcomings, their own failures, and really their own issues that they haven't dealt with. And hopefully you have coaches that allow your children and, you know, as a parent, you've offering your children the best solutions, the best examples, free of their own fucking problems, and, you know, to do that unabated. But that's not it. There's a lot of fucked up people because they have fucked up parents. Mm-hmm. And what do I always say? After the age of 26, you can't blame your parents anymore. Well, people are still blaming their parents. We run into it constantly. So, but to be continued. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
Bye.
Bye.